Hello, this is Dr. Laura Hannes-Webb of VisionarySoul.com. Welcome to the Sweet Spot Program. Tune in weekly to find where your passion meets your purpose. This show is committed to helping you find, embrace, and live in your sweet spot. You can find us online at SweetSpotPodcast.com, PsychJourneyPodcast.com, and iTunes, among many other places. And this week, I'm very excited to bring to you the author of Soul Currency, Investing Your Inner Wealth for Fulfillment and Abundance. And we're going to have Reverend Ernest Chu, who is a perfect guest during this time of economic crisis. Not only is he a former investment banker and member of the New York Stock Exchange, but he's also an accomplished entrepreneur and spiritual teacher. And as a investment banker and business coach, he had advised some of America's best managed companies and directly funded nearly 100 emerging growth companies. And then he made an interesting switch, and now he's an ordained pastor at the Center for Spiritual Living in Fort Lauderdale. He has led workshops on the metaphysics of spiritual abundance in more than 70 spiritual centers in 20 states. You can find him online at soulcurrency.org. But welcome, Ernest.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, I think that your story is so interesting and your message, too. I know that during this time of economic crisis, many people across the country are very literally in a state of panic. And I know from your book that you, too, had found yourself in a similar situation many years ago and yet bounced back. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal story?
Well, as you probably know, I started out on Wall Street. And, in fact, I was a columnist also for the Wall Street Journal. I had a very dull job at the time since I was probably the youngest reporter there on the paper.
Wow.
In New York. And they had me writing the bond markets column and also about the financing business column. And I got quite interested in both subjects and ultimately went on to Wall Street as my next stop. And I was there for probably almost a dozen years directly. And when I was involved with smaller companies that grew, these companies were public companies or became public companies. And so I've had a lot of experience with the capital markets, but I discovered through having a massive failure, which literally I woke up one day and found out that I had a partner that basically wasn't who he said he was and had two Social Security numbers, and a lot of the material about his background was completely, shall we say, very doubtful. Mm. And the company melted down in much the same way some of the companies today seem to melt down. The financing went away. I went through a great deal of what people are experiencing today. I couldn't pay my mortgage. I ultimately ended up, through a miracle, ended up being able to sell my house at a very attractive price for the buyer. And I was at a point in my life where I went through and couldn't pay any of my bills. And when I went to a grocery store, I couldn't buy 99% of what I looked at. I could have said, well, I guess I've had it with the financial side of things. But my real passion had been to be involved in the financial aspects of companies and transactions and things of that type. And so I couldn't declare bankruptcy. So I was $1 million in debt. And basically, a lot of that was, you know, my own doing, because I did probably what I would tell people not to do, which is when you start your company, don't put all your money in from credit cards and so forth. And I had sort of leveraged myself up in, again, much the same way that some things are happening today. And basically, I woke up one day and realized that if I had got a job paying me $150,000 a year and could pay off $1,000 to $2,000 of my debt, it would take me about 200 years before I'd even make a dent in it. So I had to find something. I wasn't quite sure what it was, but ultimately it ended up, I found it at a, place in Morristown, New Jersey. It was the Church of Religious Science at that particular time. But it was, I think, a destination and a spiritual calling as well. And so I ended up listening about really how my thinking needed to change, and really literally that there was a power for good and I could use it, both of which I probably knew at some level, but had long forgotten. And so this really was an opportunity for me to be able to do that. It took me about 18 months. I had everything fully resolved, and I had paid off virtually all of my debt. And essentially, I had 5 more years where I realized that this was a spiritual calling, not a financial crisis, that Spirit was trying to get my attention. And obviously, it got my attention in the place that I live in, which was at that time the financial markets. I never realized until that time just how much of an illusion financial currency is. Financial currency is nothing more than symbols and agreements. And when you basically add fear to the equation, you get agreements that change very rapidly, usually for the worse. And so that's pretty much what you see when you saw the stock markets really going down, the mortgage crisis, the bank failures, and so forth. A lot of this was a crisis of confidence, but it also is really, it should be very clear, and it was certainly clear to me, that this is probably one of the first times that in my knowledge, since I've been doing this, that it was so clear what was real and what wasn't. You could look at really that financial currency and, for instance, the whole area of what they call derivatives, which are simply securitized assets that are leveraged up, meaning people borrow against them, and so they really only don't even have any equity in these things. Those are really fiction. These things are almost like monopoly money. It got me really thinking, and I started to do this probably about 10 years ago. I started to think that there was something more, that was something a lot truer. And what I did find was that the real currency is what I call soul currency, which is really that those inner qualities within you that you take pretty much for granted. Maybe your aunt has told you that you have a knack for words, or a gift for gab, or basically have an eye for color, or a real, real good way of making people laugh. But you take these things, and it's good to know about these things. But we don't really take these things as gospel. We don't really regard them as being worth anything, especially when we get into the area of money. We look back and say, well, gee, I don't have anything. And so today, the way we probably best would handle ourselves would be to just look within and start to realize that it's not about the stock market that's falling. That's going to fall and that's going to rise, and it's one big game. It's not even about the dollar or the dollars that you're making, because the dollars probably are going to also be rising in value or falling in value relative to other currencies in the world. And the really only true currency is the soul's currency, and that is really within you, and you have an unlimited amount of that. But most of us don't even realize that we are sitting on really a treasure trove, a bank account that is just ever increasing of inner wealth. And if you don't recognize it, it's just like having an asset and not doing anything with it. Wow. And so a lot of us don't do very much with it.
You know, I was really struck when you said that part of the reason we got into this economic crisis was because of what you called securitized assets, whose value was really either unknown or like you said, monopoly money. It was fictional. Yeah. And I love how your book, in contrast to, for example, securitized assets, you talk about spiritual assets and how going through, and the book guides the reader through this process of what are your spiritual assets, and works to convince the reader that that is where your real value lies. Can you give us some examples. What do you mean by spiritual assets? How can we find them? And how does that relate to our net worth?
Well, here's an example. You probably recall that the author of Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, and for many, many years, she had quite an imagination, almost to the point that she used to keep journals and so forth. And luckily for her, she had parents that encouraged her to do that. But when she became a parent, she had to, quote, earn a living, and so she became a teacher and a translator. And finally, there was a part of her imagination that really wanted to express itself. It just had to. She felt this urge and yearning, which many of us do. But, you know, often we say, well, we have to really take into account the, quote, real world, which I think we have things a little bit backward. But so what would a week's worth of J.K. Rowling's imagination be worth? Say the Disney company decided, hey, we'd like to hire her for a week to really use her imagination to come up with our, you know, our next big thing. And, you know, that number, I would guarantee you, would be probably, you know, in the millions.
Yeah.
Now, we haven't developed a lot of our assets to that point. Mm-hmm. But what I'm pointing out is that there's a direct correlation between what you have inside and what you can create in the world itself. Mm-hmm. And another example might be Jim Henson. I mean, Jim Henson really had children of his own that he wanted to entertain. He had and the same thing with Barney. These things were developed by parents or people who love children and wanted to have something different to entertain them with. And these things became so real and so universal, they really, in a sense, help people develop their inner spiritual assets. They opened their heart. They really allowed people to express themselves. And also, when you worked for Henson Productions, a lot of times they would sit in these creative sessions and they would laugh all day because they would be talking about sketches and things for the Muppets. And what a job that was. And it wasn't a bad investment either, because when Jim Henson died and had to sell his company, he sold it for $345 million.
Wow.
And he also made a pretty good living in the meantime. So this isn't a fiction. It's not something that says you're a better person, you've got all this stuff inside of you. This is real. I mean, I would have been the last person with my background to write a book on spirituality and spiritual assets of all things if I hadn't really experienced that whole thing for myself and saw that my whole life turned around when I began to realize how much value I had, and that what I had to do was to use it instead of looking for something on the outside, like a miracle, to bail me out.
Wow. So if there's someone listening to this, and I know many people across the country, whether they're getting it from watching the media and are just concerned about the future, or if they've seen some you know, crisis in their own personal lives, and if they're sitting there in a state of panic, what advice would you have for them? And I know you have some very pointed messages about what fear. You actually equate fear with counterfeit currency. Can you say some more about that?
Well, first of all, I would, to answer your first question, I would say that basically the first thing you'd like to do is turn off the TV.
Yeah, I think that's good
advice. I am serious.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and this is nothing about, this is an industry that, quote, reports the news, but it's also an industry that depends on ratings, and so the more sensational something is, the better it is for ratings. And so turn off the TV, that's the first thing, and don't turn it back on. Mm. I think that literally that's going to give you some peace right away. Put on some soft music. Then literally sit down and really be if you have difficulty thinking about, you know, your inner wealth, because most people aren't used to thinking of it that way, then think about literally what you're grateful for, what you're happy about, about yourself about. So as an example, one way I give my students an opportunity to really find out about themselves is a little exercise. You carry a little pad or a notebook with you, and the exercise is every hour of the day, no matter whether you're at work or, you know, you're brushing your teeth or whatever, write down something every hour. Write down two things that you've caught yourself doing well.
Mm.
Now, after about a day or so, and sometimes for the hard cases, 2 or 3 days, you suddenly get it. You suddenly realize that you really have, you really do a lot of things very well. That all the things that you thought about yourself, you know, in terms of your limitations and in terms of what I call counterfeit currency, because these, it's against the law to print phony $100 bills. You'd have the feds on you in a heartbeat.
Right.
But there probably should be a law about passing phony stories around about yourself. And in fact, if somebody else, like a friend of yours or somebody who knew about some of the things you tell yourself, and even tell others, if they started spreading those stories, you would be furious. You would say, you know, these are all lies. Of course they are. But in the most case, you're the one that is spreading those things about yourself because you think that basically you're passing them off because maybe that's going to make you feel better. And in a lot of cases, we think that people they think that they're going to be able to find love outside of themselves. And so many, many people basically do things in such a way that people, they can then look at or attract things from the outside instead of creating them from the inside. So as an example, someone is always suffering, always having, you know, they never can get something. When good comes to them, just before it gets there, something happens. If you are carrying a counterfeit currency that everything's a struggle, well then, you know, an opportunity comes and you have to really struggle to really make it happen because your belief is that's what it's going to take. And so you create a lot of this stuff. And I've also told people, I said, I love that commercial that Staples puts out. They have a big thing, they have a big button. It's called the Easy Button, you know, and I really recommend that, you know, you should go and get that Easy Button and put it on your desk because, you know, life was never meant to be a struggle. It's meant to be easy. It's just the way we all believe that it should be because we've been taught that life is a struggle. And also that we don't deserve. So the Easy Button should remind us that not only do we deserve, but we deserve to have this and that life can come easily rather than with struggle.
Mm. Wow. And so for some of us, that requires a radical revisioning of what we've been taught. And it reminds me a little bit of what you kind of coin a new word in your book, and you call it adventure prize. What is that, and what meaning might that have to, say again, the listener who is in a bit of a panic right now about what's going to happen next?
Well, the adventure prize, as it's used in the book, really is about really is a combination of adventure and enterprise, and the adventure really is that adventure of life as you flow through it, as opposed to struggle through it, and it's the newness and it's the change and embracing and exploring greater parts of yourself. And the enterprise part is really what I call the enterprise of the soul. It's not about being busier. It's not about making things, quote, happen. I know a lot of the motivational speakers talk about making things happen. It's about being more. You see, being is also an action step. You know,
That's the first time I've ever heard someone say that.
Well, it is an action step. Being is an action step. And literally, that's where all the inspiration comes from. Mm-hmm. You know, the action steps maybe after that are to get patents and form a company and whatever. Mm-hmm. But the point is that the first action step is the being. And so you allow, say, the the inspiration to come through. You allow clarity to be there. You set your intention. And so these are really very powerful action steps that you can take. They don't require you to physically, get up and run around and be busy. In fact, busyness actually complicates things, and sometimes it even interferes with your thinking processes. And so I really think that most people tend to have a dream or tend to basically invest what I call invest their soul currency or invest their spiritual capital into things like their children, their pets, so forth. And literally the answer when you invest spiritual currency or spiritual capital is that you don't have any real expectation. There's a flow to it. You're giving it really unconditionally. But you see, it does come back to you, because it comes back to you in the sense of, if you really look at that as an investment that has, a long tail to it, this might be, as an example, when I went to visit the Dalai Lama, this is something that happened. I had no idea. I went there just because I just wanted to learn from him, and there was an opportunity to really sit with a group of ecumenical clergy to listen to him talk about consciousness and things. Mm-hmm. And so I sat there. Now, along the way, I decided I really wanted to support the new monastery that was being created in Bloomington, Indiana. So I went there to make a donation, and they invited me to stay for dinner. And I sat down at dinner, and there were some other people there. And lo and behold, the person that sat right across the table from me was an inventor that had just started a small company and had patents and had a whole lot of things. And I just went, wow, this fits all my criteria. And here I am in the middle of Bloomington.
Wow.
at a dinner surrounded by monks and basically not having any expectation that I would ever sit down and there would be this wonderful company. And so this kind of thing happens because basically when you invest your spiritual capital and you, in a sense, give it away and be unattached to how it really comes back to you, it comes back in ways that are amazing. And the same thing is when you basically have a dream that you're pursuing. And that dream, for instance, might be a particular product or an organization or a sanctuary for wildlife or whatever that is, when you start to invest your spiritual capital in it, and you really focus on that, you become that dream. And what happens is that instead of you dreaming the dream, being the dreamer, you become the dream. And,
oh, wow.
And obviously spirit is the dreamer.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, Reverend Ernest, I wonder if you could let our listeners know where they can find you, where they can find your book, and if you could remind us the title of the book also.
Well, the title of the book is Soul Currency, Investing Your Inner Wealth for Fulfillment and Abundance. And you can get it on www.soulcurrency.org. And when you go on there, if you are looking to create more prosperity and more peace and more harmony in your life, I'm giving away, in a sense, you can just click on the special gift, which is essentially you'll get 7 days email to you of positive affirmative prayers, much like the same things that I use to get myself completely out of debt and to realize what my soul currency is. And, it's my hope that each of you listening today will have the opportunity to look within and realize how much spiritual capital you have and how powerful your soul currency is.
Wow, it's really amazing coming from you, because you have both a background in business and even the markets, and then here we are in the middle of this crisis, and you yourself have come through the fire, so to speak, with such a difficult journey. So you're both an inspiration and a guide, I think, for everyone listening. So thank you very much, Reverend Chu.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, take care.
Okay.
Bye.